Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our multi-county listening area in central Iowa. I am one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, here with my co-host, Greta Anderson. Hello, Greta.
Hello, Susan, and hello to you, the listener. What a beautiful day we've got for Memorial Day. Can't wait to get out in my garden and enjoy the peonies.
This holiday always takes me back to my childhood, where we cut peonies, pink peonies, from our garden to take to my grandmother's grave. Only later did I realize that it was mostly associated with war dead.
Peonies or poppies?
Well, I meant the holiday.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've always thought peonies were associated. I think peonies have this, the root is good for childbirth, so it's the opposite side of things. But anyway, yeah, I say that Memorial Day is a puzzling holiday. You know, is it about patriotism? Is it about death? We've already got Veterans Day, and we've already got Day of the Dead. So what really is Memorial Day?
Well, it's only after I questioned the difference that I realized how distinct the two holidays really are in their origin and purpose. So that's what I want to explore today.
So what's the difference between Memorial Day and Veterans Day?
Well, Veterans Day is about veterans, many living veterans, and they parade to honor their service to their country, and they are recognized for their service to their country. Parades and uniforms are part of the celebration. It was originally Armistice Day to celebrate the end of World War I, the war to end all wars. Unfortunately, there have been a lot of wars since then, and a lot of veterans.
So Memorial Day is not necessarily about veterans.
It's more inclusive. It's for anyone we want to memorialize. And there are a greater number of ways to acknowledge it, from a visit to a national cemetery like Arlington, which was founded for the Union dead after the American Civil War, to simple family gatherings to visit relatives' graves nearby. And as people move so much, fewer graves are visited by relatives, and Memorial Day becomes simply the beginning of summer.
I always think of it as the day the pool opens. I'm sure a lot of kids do.
Yes. Summer is really something to celebrate, especially when we live here in Iowa, where the demarcation is pretty important.
Well, I know that it's important for us to all honor our are those who have passed, and really the way their contributions have changed our world.
Yes.
And so I think Memorial Day is a great idea. I like it better as a non-patriotic holiday.
Well, we have both. So we're going to start, though, by talking about some of the veteran aspects of this with a reflection on poppies and patriotism by our Nevada correspondent, Henry Corbin. Henry is with us for one last time, and he has prepared something, and he wants to tell you about it.
Well, good morning. And first, I'd like to start out by saying I've been an intern here for 6 weeks now, and sadly, today is my last day. And so I just wanted to say thank you to KHOI for just giving me the greatest learning opportunity I could have ever had. I've had so much fun, and just thank you for putting up with me for those 6 weeks.
Oh, are you kidding me, Henry? You've been a blessing to us. All of your inside Nevada connections. I did not really appreciate the community quite until you came along and had all those insights into Nevada.
Well, thank you. It's been fun. I've loved every minute here. So I leave today with a salute to our great country and community and our veterans. When I started to write this story, I originally was only going to cover the symbolism behind the poppy as a sign of remembrance. But as I dove into this story, it developed into a larger one. Growing up in a small town, Memorial Day has always been a very visible holiday. American flags line Main Street and Lincoln Way. The small red paper flowers the American Legion hands out on the corner of Main Street. There are plenty of visual representations of it all around us, but what do they mean? What are these little red flowers, and why are they a sign for remembrance? French Flanders, a region in France home to some of the worst fighting in the First World War. During the month of May, a Canadian officer named John McCrae, after proceeding over a close friend's funeral, noticed how poppies grew on the freshly dug graves. He sat down and wrote the poem known today as In Flanders Fields. In Flanders Fields, the poppies blow, between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place, and in the sky, the larks still bravely singing fly. Scarce heard amid the guns below, we are the dead. Short days ago, we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe, to you from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields. In Flanders Fields, a poem written by Canadian soldier John McCrae on May 3, 1915. In the years since the First World War, the poppy has come to represent remembering the men and the women who lost their lives in battle. Yet the poppy wasn't always a symbol of remembrance. It was once nothing more than a weed. The plant germinates in disturbed soil. There they would grow rampant in European farmers' fields and spread like wildfire after a field was worked. This trait was how they became a symbol of the First World War. In the war-torn battlefields, ripped apart by artillery and by trenches, the poppy flourished. The flowers spread, covering the once torn countryside with its vibrant red flowers. Eventually, the poem inspired another to create what we know as the remembrance poppy. In recent years, the poppy has been even adopted into the hijab. A red poppy version of it was created by British Muslim students who also wanted to use it on Remembrance Sunday, but to commemorate the 400,000 Muslim soldiers and the 1.2 million Indian soldiers who fought alongside British troops in World War I. The poppy has become known through many other countries, including Ireland, England, and throughout many of the UK, United States, and others. The white poppy is a version of the red poppy. It's been created for the Peace Pledge Union, and it is to not support any kind of war, but to remember those who did fall. The purple poppy represents animal losses in World War I. It was created in recent years to help remember those forgotten victims, the horses and many other animals used throughout the war. In 2014, around the Tower of London, a piece of art known as Blood-Swept Lands was created. It filled the moat surrounding the castle with 888,246 ceramic poppies to represent each British or colonial life lost. I recommend for you to look it up. It's an amazing sight, and it really puts it into perspective. It amazed me to see it, because when you see the number or you hear the number, it's just a number. However, when it's put in front of you in a visual way, it's mind-boggling and amazing how many people they lost. One of the first U.S. soldiers killed in combat in World War I was an Iowan, Merle Hay, from Glidden. The first U.S. woman to die of injuries in a combat zone was also an Iowan, Marion Crandall, formerly a French teacher at St. Catherine's School in Davenport. What amazed me when I was researching the story was how a symbol that has become so sacred came from just a simple weed. The men it came to represent had probably spent most of their lives fighting to kill it off from their farm fields. And when I thought about that, I realized how many of the soldiers fighting in that war were probably farmers themselves. Some were probably fighting in the fields they had worked. I remembered from a section in a speech I had wrote for a scholarship last year, where I briefly mentioned my connection in between agriculture and war. Last year, Story County sent its last honor flight to Washington, D.C. to visit the memorials. I was honored to be a speaker at their send-off. I won a scholarship from the American Legion, and we were to write a paper entitled, What Does Freedom Mean to My Family? So I would like to read my essay for you today. I hope you will enjoy listening to this as much as I enjoyed writing it. It allowed me to better understand where our past generations have come from and what they have been through to ensure that we can live the life that we live. What does freedom mean to my family? What does freedom mean to my family? Everything. My family's history of living in the United States has gone back since the times of colonial days. We have been bankers, teachers, mechanics, physicians, milkmen, police officers, and almost any other position you can think of. But none of this would have been possible without the freedom that was given to us. My family has always been willing to fight to ensure that this right remains for generations of my family to come. Many of my ancestors, both men and women, fought to keep this right, serving in every conflict from the American Revolutionary War through the conflicts of today. My grandpa Stahl served in the Korean conflict from 51 to 53. He served as a mechanic near the front. He himself was a mere farmer in central Iowa, and many of the people he encountered living in Korea were of the same profession. I have had the privilege of growing up listening to stories of Korea and all the events he saw. I have heard him describe the country and the people. Over the years, he has told me he wants to one day go back and visit Seoul. He described the trip over on a ship and how in those days it was not very pleasant below deck. It was a grueling trip. He told me how when he arrived, they were transported on flatbed rail cars, and the train he was on passed through the city of Seoul, or what was left of it. He said the city was almost flat. People were living in run-down shacks. The city had been torn apart by war. He said that he saw the nation of Korea at its worst, and that now that it is a bustling modern country, he would like to see it again, to truly see what he was fighting for. Through him, I have learned to appreciate all things and that nothing that we have in the United States should ever be taken for granted. I know that freedom comes with a price. I think it is also important to me because I would not be able to live my life the way I do. I have grown up hearing stories about rationing and the scrap metal drives of World War II. It gave me insight into how lucky my generation is. We don't have to grow our own gardens. We don't have to conserve rubber and gasoline. We don't have the draft. My grandma Stahl was actually crowned the queen of the paper drive in Tampa, Florida, in her middle school. My generation is a very lucky generation to have had our future made possible by the previous generations. We have had the road paved for us by the sacrifices of those who came before us. And I sometimes wonder if my generation truly appreciates what has been given to us. It is our turn to do something with a great opportunity. But as we move forward, we have to remember all those who came before us, what they gave up and what they lost, so we, the future, could live free. Without this freedom, my generation would never even have the chance to become a great generation that the forefathers hoped that we would become. They have shown us that love of a country and land can never come lightly. Thank you. Though my grandfather did not want to go in the beginning, he went because he said that was the right thing to do. And many other farmers left during war. They go not because they have to, but because something calls to them. The fact to defend their families, to fight for the freedoms they've been given, or just to be an American. Through the connection in agriculture, I've realized how many of our farmers are veterans, and how many of them went to war from the farms, left what they wanted to do. Many of them just wanted to be farmers, but when their nation called, they went. So many of them didn't come back, but those who did went back to what they did. They farmed. They didn't want any special thank yous. They did what they thought was right. And because of them, we can live the lives that we live. These people whose job is to bring life into the world through the plants they raise and the families they raise on those farms, they were sent to a terrible place full of just death. However, when they came home, they didn't let it destroy them. They went forward, they planted a crop, they raised their families, and they moved on. Yet today, we remember them, the ones who didn't come home and the ones who did. However, can we sum up how much they gave us with just one day? So today I ask that if you see a veteran, thank them, for they gave the ultimate sacrifice. They lost friends, family, or maybe a little bit of themselves. However, they are here, and because of them we are. So see a veteran and thank them, not just today, but any time through the year.
I walked through a county courthouse square. On a park bench, an old man was sitting there. I said, your old courthouse is kind of run down. He said, no, it'll do for our little town. I said, your old flagpole has leaned a little bit, and that's a ragged old flag you got hanging on it. He said, have a seat. And I sat down. Is this the first time you've been to our little town? I said, I think it is. He said, I don't like to brag, but we're kind of proud of that ragged old flag. You see, we got a little hole in that flag there when Washington took it across the Delaware. And it got powder burned the night that Francis Scott Key sat watching it write and say, can you see? And it got a bad rip in New Orleans with Pakenham and Jackson tugging at its seams. And it almost fell at the Alamo beside the Texas flag, but she waved on, though. She got cut with a sword at Chancellorsville, and she got cut again at Shiloh Hill. There was Robert E. Lee, Beauregard, and Bragg, and the south wind blew hard on that ragged old flag. On Flanders Field in World War I, she got a big hole from a Bertha gun. She turned blood red in World War II. She hung limp and low a time or two. She was in Korea, Vietnam. She went where she was sent by her Uncle Sam. She waved from our ships upon the briny foam, and now they've about quit waving back here at home. In her own good land here, she's been abused. She's been burned, dishonored, denied, and refused. And the government for which she stands is scandalized throughout the land. And she's getting threadbare and she's wearing thin, but she's in good shape for the shape she's in. 'Cause she's been through the fire before. And I believe she can take a whole lot more. So we raise her up every morning. We take her down every night. We don't let her touch the ground, and we fold her upright. On second thought, I do like to brag, 'cause I'm mighty proud of that ragged old flag.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Greta Anderson, and my co-host, Susan Franzen, and I are drawing on many sources to explore Memorial Day. You just heard from Henry Corbin. And as we recognize his contributions to today's program, we want to thank him for all he's done for KHOI. During the 6 weeks he's been an intern here, it's just been marvelous to have you. He's a quick study and very personable and wonderful to have around. His internship officially ends today as he begins his summer classes. I guess you don't have any classes today, but
no, not today, luckily.
But he's going on in DMAC in agribusiness, and he'll be traveling all the way out to a farm in Adel to study agriculture. During his short time here, he's done several interviews for us and has even co-hosted a couple times. We'll miss you, Henry, and hope you come back to visit us when your schedule permits and keep us in touch with happenings in your wonderful little town of Nevada.
Well, thank you. And it's been so much fun, and I was so glad I could do it. And so thank you.
And I'd like to add my appreciation to Greta's also. As a person who's most focused on programs in our listening area beyond Ames, I want to tell Henry how great it has been to have you, such a knowledgeable person, as part of our Local Talk team. Thanks.
Thank you.
And now we turn to another member of our team, Kay Puttock, who has prepared a special Memorial Day tribute for Rich Van Valen. Now, this is in a very, very different vein than the patriotic poppy stories and very moving stories that Henry prepared. Rich was one of the founders of the Senior Disc Golf League in Ames, and he died last year. And the league is also known as the Ames Basket Cases, referring to the special baskets on poles used to catch the discs, which replace the holes in a regular golf course. This piece also memorializes Steady Ed Hedrick, known as the father of disc golf, the inventor of the first disc golf basket and the first disc golf course. The piece begins with the voice of Rich Van Valen's good friend Dennis Dake reading a poem called The Senior Disc Golfers. The poem was written by Rich's son, Joel Van Valen.
The Senior Disc Golfers. They play disc golf. They do not keep score. They amble among the old red oaks, now russet with fall, and are strong enough now to no longer need a country club, its caddies and manicured greens and vodka martinis. They are happy to let the young men play through. They trickle down fairways and watch their throws like little wheeling suns float and turn to the wind. They are not upset if they veer into a copse, the next tangled adventure awaiting. They are wise enough now to know the feel of time. It's all in the flick of the wrist.
That poem by Joel Van Valen, whose late father, Rich Van Valen, was one of the founders of the Senior Disc Golf League. The poem was read by Rich Van Valen's good friend, who is here with me in the studio today. I'm here with Dennis Dake to talk about the Senior Disc Golf League, which he helped found. And he helped found it with Rich Van Valen. So since this is Memorial Day, it's a nice memorial for Rich. I should mention, too, that Dennis has a T-shirt on for the Senior Disc Golf League, and it's got the basket that the discs catch, and it says Ames Basket Cases.
That's our title.
Nice yellow T-shirt.
Welcome. And matching cap.
Oh, and matching cap. Welcome, Dennis. So glad you could
Thank
come.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you and Rich started the disc golf.
Yes.
The Senior Disc Golf League.
We didn't know it was going to be a league when we started, but in 2008, I retired from the faculty at Iowa State and was looking around for things to do. And I was over at Rich's and Lynn's Van Valen's house, and it was to celebrate his birthday. And he said he had gotten a series of discs from his daughter Lisa, who lives up in the Twin Cities, and his son plays, who also lives up in the Twin Cities, but he didn't know anybody down here and didn't know who he would play with. And I said, well, just on the spur of the moment, I said, I'll buy some discs and we'll try it out and see what it's like. So,
and I see you brought some discs with
you. I brought my bag of discs just for...
Yeah, it's a whole bag full of different...
Everybody teases me because I have so many.
Well, it's like, it's almost like golf clubs. You've got all sorts of discs to choose for different kind of throws, I guess.
You have drivers, and you have mid-ranges, and you have putters, and they come in different weights. And so the better you get, I guess you specialize in certain discs, certain brand names, and ones that really please you and that you find you can control well.
Okay, so the two of you set out to...
So we set out. We have two wonderful disc golf courses here, one maintained by the university, which is where we started. It's called Stable Run. It's on 13th Street. We started out playing there. We had no idea what the rules were. We had no idea how to throw the discs or anything. And the two of us just went, and we started in August of 2008, and we just went out and had a lot of fun, and we thought, this is really a great time. So towards the end of the fall season, several other people joined us from here in Ames, and there were four or five of us for a year or so. And gradually everybody was having so much fun, so they would tell someone else. And then a couple years later, Rich said, why don't we teach a class at OLLI, the College for Seniors? And so four times we've taught that class, Introduction to Disc Golf, and Rich and I were two of the instructors.
So between that time, between the time you started and when you started teaching the class, you must have learned the rules, I guess.
We did. The Professional Disc Golf Association, there's actually a whole association of, and they set the rules for disc golf. We play a little loose with them sometimes. We just enjoy it so much that we don't always stay very close to the... But the rules are essentially like a lot like ball golf, except that you don't have a hole in the ground. You have a basket with chains above it that catch the disc if you're lucky enough to hit it squarely, and it falls down into a basket. And that's the way you hole out instead of going putting into a hole in the ground.
Now, you mentioned the second disc golf course. I'm familiar with the one at Gateway, but I didn't know about this other one.
The other one, the university's on 13th Street, is called Stable Run, I gather, because they used to have horses, and so they must have used that. It's across Squaw Creek from the new water park, Ames Water Park. And then the other one, as you mentioned, is down at Gateway Park, and it's part of the old golf and country club that's
right.
left.
You can still occasionally find the odd golf ball down there, occasionally. I used to find a lot down there. I always, before it was a disc golf place, I used
now,
to walk
now,
my
now you can find discs that are lost in the weeds and things.
Yeah, there's a lot of, do you call them hazards? There's a lot of, I mean, the discs can land in the river or whatever.
They have, and I've lost one down there. One time, one of the other fellows said, throw the floater, because most discs don't float, but that one is designed to float. And he said, throw the floater, and I threw it where I couldn't see the basket, and it went right over the basket and into the creek.
Right, there's one basket right down on, I suppose you call it the beach.
Yeah.
And then if you throw towards that one, you can't, when you're throwing from the spot, you can't see it. And it
you
goes
can't in, see it, but it went right over and into, it was a bit flooded, and it... probably in New Orleans by now or something.
Yeah, I used to walk my dog there, and once or twice she did rescue people's discs. She'd get very excited to go out, because that's one of the things I had to train her to do, was not to chase people's discs when she was down there.
I've known some of the young folks who take off their shoes and when it's not so high and walk along looking for discs. So.
Now, I believe at the Stable Run golf course or disc golf course, you've got a special memorial for Rich there.
We do. Rich was such a good friend, one of the best friends I've ever had in my life. And he was so much fun. And when he died, his widow, Lynn, gave us the opportunity to remember him by giving us a few of his ashes. And his son, Joel, who wrote the poem, was down to Ames. And he came out with us, and we had a little ceremony on hole number 8. And the reason for hole number 8 is that on hole number 8, just in front of the concrete tee pad that you throw from, about 10 feet in front are two trees less than 6 feet apart. And so we always call them the goalpost trees, because you have to get through the middle or else you get the disc bouncing back at you if you hit them squarely or off to the side into the weeds if you hit them on the side. And Rich, in his joking way, he always had jokes to give us and keep us laughing as we went around, used to say, trust me, I'm a scientist, I'm a chemist, and one out of every four will hit one of those trees. It's a proven fact. So we called that the Van Valen curse. And it would worry us if three of us got through. The fourth one was a little worried, and sometimes it proved that we did hit it. But after he died, Lynn gave us a few of his ashes, and Joel came out. We had a little ceremony by those trees, and his ashes were sprinkled around the two trees. So as far as I'm concerned, those two trees are a living memorial, although very battered because people hit them a lot. And every time since then, and we go out there sometimes three times a week, every time when we get to hole 8, I go up before we start to throw the discs, and I put my hand on both trees and remember Rich and think about him. So I think that's wonderful that you're given this opportunity to remember a very fine person who's brought a lot of joy to a lot of people who were part of the Ames basket cases. So and it's a really good way to remember him, because the founder of disc golf, Ed Hedrick, when he died, had his will specified that his ashes would be put into discs. And they raised money from the sale of these discs to create the International Disc Golf Headquarters in Georgia, in rural Georgia, where the Professional Disc Golf Association is headquartered. And the stipulation was further that on the day of the opening of the International Disc Golf Headquarters, his widow was instructed to throw one of the discs up onto the roof of the building, because Ed always said old disc golfers never die. They just land on the roof and stay there. So to this day, there's the Steady Ed. They call him Steady Ed, Steady Ed Hedrick disc on the International Disc Golf. And we have two trees in memory, living trees in memory of Rich Van Valen.
That's terrific. Oh. I don't know the Stable Run golf course at all, but at Gateway. And it's a very scenic course down there at Gateway. I mean, there's lots of uphills and downs, and you can go up through right. trees, and as we've mentioned, the river, and then they mow the lawn in different ways too, yeah. like fairway and rough, I suppose.
They call things that aren't in the fairway the out of bounds, OB uh-huh. for short. The city maintains the Gateway course really beautifully, and they've been doing an even better job of getting better and better at the Iowa State one. There's a young fellow there, and he's been cleaning things up and they're regularly mowing the fairways. So it's really, we're very advantaged here. Both of the courses here are classed world class.
Really?
Because in 2000, the world championships were held here and in Des Moines. There's a number of courses down in Des Moines area. So that's when I first saw anybody even play it. I had no idea what it was, but that was back in 2000 when I saw it. So when Rich showed me the disc, I related to it in that way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, when I'm walking my dog down there, most of the people playing at Gateway are young. But they you are. Guys are, you're called Senior Disc Golf, and you are older guys, mostly retired people, right?
Yes, that's sort of where we by going through OLLI, you have people that are over 50 that are members of OLLI, and so we've tended to do people that can come out during the day, and mm-hmm, although mm-hmm. we have a few that still work.
And is this for men only?
No, we've trained a number of women. We have one that comes out fairly regularly with
us.
Oh, okay.
It's not like a men's group thing. It is mostly men. But
it's mostly men, I guess, just because we know each other from other circumstances. And we join with friends and uh-huh. things like that. But, no, we have one woman, and she would love to have others. So,
talking of having others, we can add it again at the end, and we'll put it on our website. But what's the contact information if people want to get hold of you to join?
Well, I maintain the email list, which is the way we announce that we're going out for a round. And so they can get a hold of me at my I still have my university email address and or my phone, either way.
Okay, so it's
DDAKE for Dennis Dake.
Okay, iastate.edu. As I say, we'll put that on our website.
Okay.
So if there's any ladies out there in particular, I guess, or other men that want to join.
Right. I just taught two men, brought them out to the house and gave them a few lessons, and they've started playing. So we're constantly looking for people that like to go out. We usually have between 6 and as many as 15 people that'll show up on any given day that we announce we're having an official round. Sometimes people, come out on their own, find their own friends from in the group or outside the group.
Okay.
A lot of people find, since a lot of young people play it, like they find their children or grandchildren play regularly, and so.
So it's a nice intergenerational.
It's a nice intergenerational thing. Although the young people have such strong arms and limber bodies that they tend to be very. That's a reason to have a senior disc golf league, so we can play the shorter holes and. And make it more fun for everyone.
So when Rich was alive, how many years did you do disc golfing together?
From 2008 until he died. About 6 years, I think.
Okay. I've been talking to Dennis Dake, who, along with Rich Van Valen, who's deceased and whom we're remembering today on Memorial Day, who founded the Senior Disc Golf League, or the Ames Basket Cases. Thank you very much, Dennis.
You're welcome.
And if you'd like to join the Senior Disc Golfers or the Ames Basket Cases, drop an email to Dennis at ddake, D-D-A-K-E, at iastate.com. kpuddock.edu.
And thanks to Kay Puddock for preparing that moving tribute to Rich Van Valen, whose zest for life was expressed in his many pursuits, but certainly not least in his interest in senior disc golf. This is KHOI Community Radio, and I'm Greta Anderson, one of your hosts for today, Memorial Day, together with Susan Franzen. So, Susan, what do you have in store for the end of our program?
Well, we're really shifting gears. You know, I started talking about...
Shifting gears, that's appropriate, because one of Rich's other passions was bicycling.
Yes. Well, there are always connections, Henry was listening to this before he left for his family gathering for Memorial Day. He said, oh, I used to play disc golf, and I saw those guys, and they were really good. They could throw farther than we could. So we're going to be going back to the cemetery quite literally. Our guests will be Pat Shaw, who has for many years been involved with the State Association for the Preservation of Iowa Cemeteries, also known as SAPIC.
SAPIC. SAPIC. Why, of course.
Yes. But anyway, this, of course, deals with pioneer cemeteries, and it's not something we think very much about, but this is where people still bring peonies, or there are peonies planted, incidentally. I went to the Oakwood Cemetery in Moingona yesterday, and it was full of flowers, but the peonies were all the ones that were on the bushes. So anyway, so we'll be talking with her, but I'd like to make a transition, a musical transition, with a song that represents the idea of the family cemetery. Let the circle be unbroken.
When I saw that hearse come rolling for to carry my mother away, will the sun
We have Pat Shaw on the line?
Yes, we do.
Thank you. Hi, Pat. So glad you could be with us.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to talk about the preservation of Iowa's pioneer burial sites.
Well, I think that most Iowans live in such places that they probably aren't even aware these exist.
That could be possible.
So how did the organization that you belong to, the State Association for the Preservation of Iowa Cemeteries, get started?
It was founded in 1996 by a group of concerned citizens who were preservationists, and they were concerned about the fact that many of Iowa's small pioneer burial sites were in isolated places that were being destroyed by farming practices, or just by neglect, just being overgrown with forest trees and grass. And some of these pioneer burial sites are so isolated And we're still discovering them today. They're being discovered by hunters a lot, and people who are looking for their ancestors and not able to find their burial sites, and they're finding them in places like this.
Well, I noticed that your website is on Ancestry.com.
Yes.
Interested me also because I had discovered another website on Ancestry.com called Find a Grave.
Yes.
Which is the significance to me of those online resources is that people who really can't get out to these often remote and hard to find cemeteries, because some of them are on private land, right?
They are.
They can still find who's buried there because of this enormous amount of work that various interested volunteers have done around the country.
That's correct. The Internet has provided a lot of information for people who are researching their families. And many times in Iowa, as other Midwestern states, people were constantly moving westward back in these days in the 1800s. So the descendants of these people who are buried there are no longer here. And the State Association for the Preservation of Iowa Cemeteries is trying to fill the gaps where the ancestors or the descendants are not present, and there seems to be no one really to care about them. So this organization was founded to fill that gap.
Well, how did you get involved in it?
I got involved because I saw a picture in the newspaper of a person named Dean Gipple from Loayza County. He was one of the founders of SAPIC, and he was pictured holding his arms were around a tombstone, and he was very interested in a cemetery in his area. And so he contacted the State Historical Society of Iowa, and at that time Lauren Horton, who is now a retired senior historian at that State Historical Society, formed a group of interested people, mainly people in Jasper County and Jackson County. They had already had county commissions addressing this issue. And so these people, among a few others, grassroots people, formed this organization and in 1996, and they had several meetings, and they decided to call it the State Association for the Preservation of Iowa Cemeteries. And the focus is on pioneer cemeteries that are defined as having 12 or fewer burials in the past 50 years. And the Office of the State Archaeologist defines pioneer burials as those that are 150 years or older.
The cemeteries are 150 years or older, is that?
Yes, or the burial sites. Sometimes there's just one or two burials in a field, yes, or family farm, not really a dedicated cemetery.
Well, I have a couple of fairly mundane questions. One is, I noticed that in the mission statement, it says that that such committees are allowed for each of the 99 counties. Do all of the 99 counties have county cemetery commissions?
No, they don't. The law that was written in 1998 and passed by the state legislature said that each county shall or may form a pioneer cemetery commission. And about one-third of Iowa's counties have done so. So we are constantly working with groups within these counties, presenting the idea of having a pioneer cemetery commission in their county to the county supervisors. They have to approve and create an ordinance that allows for the creation of the pioneer cemetery commission. And then that commission can assess taxes for the upkeep of the cemetery, or in many cases, the county supervisors prefer to just allow a certain amount from the general fund for this. And usually it's not a great deal, but it's enough to help volunteers provide protection for the cemeteries, usually fencing, and for the restoration of the stones in the cemetery.
Well, I have a question that is close to home for me right now because I still live in Moingona. And as you drive into Moingona on the Moingona Road, you pass an archway that says Oakwood, and that's the Oakwood Cemetery. And I have since learned that the original access to the cemetery was at the bottom of the hill because the Moingona Road was at a different place in the old days. But certainly some of those graves should go back 150 years, but there are many recent graves, and one from 2015. I was there yesterday and amazed at how many new graves there were. By new, I mean since the beginning of the current the millennium. And also how active, I mean, most of the graves that I could see had many flowers, multiple flowers. A lot of them were artificial, but it was a beautiful, beautiful decorated graveyard. And I wondered, I guess this isn't a pioneer cemetery, even though it's that as old as that.
If it's had more than 12 burials in the past 50 years, it would not be identified as pioneer.
Okay. I guess I was seeing the 12 in a different way. Okay.
But we do certainly appreciate and try to assist with active cemeteries as well as pioneer. But our focus at this point is on the rescuing and preservation and maintenance of pioneer cemeteries.
Yes, yes. And, of course, this isn't in an isolated place. This is in a place where, well, obviously, people want to be buried there. In fact, I met somebody who said her grandparents, someone who lived in the nearby, and she said her mother was buried there. So I thought that was probably one of the only recent burials. And so I was very surprised to discover how active it is. And how many people were there? I mean, this is the day before Decoration Day, and we ran into people that we chatted with as we looked through the cemetery and read the graves.
Yeah, that's interesting. Usually if the cemeteries are along the road where they're visible, they're better cared for, of course. And we are attempting, as I said before, to save the ones that are not too visible and are isolated. And it's a process. We certainly haven't gotten to the point where we've saved all these cemeteries. But they are a vital part of Iowa's history, and they can tell us a lot about the ethnic groups that settled in that area, about any diseases that might have gone through that area, and of course, people's ancestors. And that's drawing in people from all over the United States and even foreign countries who are coming here to Iowa and researching their ancestors. So it has become a tourism thing as well.
Oh, well, that's interesting. And I think this is where Find a Grave is really valuable, because what I discovered in Moingona was that the older gravestones were so badly deteriorated that I couldn't see the dates.
Exactly. That also is a problem. And sometimes we are dependent on records that are kept in genealogical societies in the county. In the 1930s, a WPA project was to record all the cemeteries in the country. That was one of the projects they gave to people to provide work for them. So those records are invaluable in finding graves that you're referring to when the stones are hardly readable anymore.
What is the greatest challenge that you are facing?
I think the greatest challenge right now is the fact that there is some apathy with regard to these cemeteries, and also with the farmland becoming so valuable in the state, sometimes these cemeteries are just obliterated for farm ground, and that's very unfortunate.
In fact, I would imagine you'd have some real conflicts there.
Yes, there are conflicts. And unfortunately, some of these small cemeteries do not have anyone to fight for them. And so it's happening without our knowledge. And that really is it's a very big loss to the historical society, societies, and to the history of Iowa.
Well, I first learned about you from Dave Gradwall, who is an archaeologist and concerned with Indian burials. And I wonder, does your purview include Indian sites?
Our organization does not specifically address that issue, but that issue is fairly well covered in the state, in this Code of Iowa, better than ours. Our association, and the Office of the State Archaeologist works with folks that find pioneer or Indian Native American burials, but they also work with our organization on pioneer burials. So we sort of work hand in hand.
You mentioned the state archaeologist also. Is he or she helpful?
Very helpful. They've become very helpful in a helpful in a situation in Jefferson County, which I live very close to that county, and there's a cemetery in a farm field that has been plowed over, and it's they have been helpful in marking where the cemetery was and determining burials that are under this cropland.
Well, it sounds like there is still a lot of work to do, and thank you so much, Pat. We've been talking with Pat Shaw from the Society.
The state, yes.
All right.
Association for the Preservation of Iowa Cemeteries. It's shortened to SAPIC, and if people just put that in their Google search, it will come to the website that we maintain.
That link will be on our website when we put up our program today. Thank you so much, Pat. And I think that this time to say goodbye.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Your hosts today have been Susan Franzen and Greta Anderson. And we started our show with Henry Corbin's memorial for Memorial Day, his speech and his story about poppies and their significance. Then with Kay Puttock and Dennis Dake talking about Rich Van Valen and disc golf, and closing with Pat Shaw of the State Association for the Preservation of Iowa Cemeteries. SAPAC, yes.
Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoyfm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. You can like us on Facebook and get updates on all of our show postings in your news feed.
Local Talk was engineered by Jonah DeGeest. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. The music that Henry Corbin played was The Ragged Old Flag by Johnny Cash from the CD, Ragged Old Flag. And we also heard Let the Circle Be Unbroken
by the Carter Family.
And
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878, or contact us through our website, khoyfm.org.
If you enjoy the show, Tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and
see you again on the radio.